Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turns blue, grace turns blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon Kamerjian, and once again, we have an incredible episode for you guys to listen to today. And I just want to let you know, before we go any further, we're not going to be taking any calls. The subject matter this evening is that vastly important that we want to make sure that we utilize every single minute that we have with our special guests so that you guys can get information that is guaranteed not anywhere on the mainstream airwaves, whether it be radio or television, period. This is an exclusive interview with none other than Keith Harmon Snow. He's our special guest today. And I just want to kind of give you a little bit of a background of Mr. Snow, and I'll let him kind of fill in the gaps because there's so much unbelievable work that this man has done. He's an independent, very, very non-corporate, I want to reiterate, a non-corporate freelance journalist. He's based in Western Massachusetts, but he's done a ton of work throughout the continent of Africa and elsewhere, specifically and focusing in areas like the Great Lakes region throughout Africa. That would include Uganda, the Congo, which we're gonna hit the ground running in terms of what's going on in the Congo. This episode should make all of you guys pissed off to a large extent, and it should move all of you guys to try to find out how you can get involved. Keith needs the support of individuals like yourselves who are listening right now, because doing what he does and exposing what he's exposing in terms of the atrocities that are going on throughout much of Africa, looking at the Congo specifically, it's not just, it's not as black and white as the mainstream media would have you believe it. And there's a huge cover-up in terms of multinational corporations, Western-based multinational corporations, as well as Western countries that are involved, that are fueling the genocide that's going on in the Congo. I mean, there's, minimally, since the 90s, there's been 10 million people have been killed because of this conflict, perhaps more. And there's a huge, huge cover-up that everyone in the mainstream media has been complicit with. And so we're going to get into that. We're going to cover a lot of stuff. And as usual, the reason we have folks on this show like Keith Harmon Snow is because he's going to be able to place things into its proper context. We're going to start off with the history of Congo, because a lot of folks may have known the Congo to be, the former Zaire, but even folks that have heard the word Congo and don't really fully understand its history, going back to looking at the forces, the European colonists, forces that first stepped foot there, such as King Leopold, and how his presence there is still being felt in Congo. So, Keith, welcome to the show. And if you could fill in the gaps, because I know there's some stuff that I missed, fill in the gaps in terms of what our listeners should also know about you. And then after you do that, can you give us a brief history of what you think the listeners should know about Congo? And I know that we're gonna get into Rwanda, how the Rwanda and Paul Kagame and Museveni in Uganda are connected to what's going on in the Congo, as well as Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and so many other folks. So welcome to the show, Keith. It's a pleasure to have you. Keith? I think we may have lost Keith for a brief second.
Can you hear me?
Actually, yeah, now I can hear you. Perfect.
Sorry,
beautiful.
I was speaking, but I guess I don't know why. Anyway, can you hear me now? How's that?
Perfectly. Hear you perfectly, Keith.
Okay. Thanks so much, Solomon, for having me on. I know you worked hard for the show, and I think we're going to give listeners something to chew on and something different from the usual nonsense. So let's shoot for that. What I think that people should take away from this conversation between you and I is an appreciation for just how much lying is going on in the media, whether it's the leftist media or the rightist media, left, middle, or center, or whatever. From The Nation to In These Times to National Public Radio to Democracy Now!, they're not going to get this kind of stuff that we're going to talk about tonight. And it's certainly not in the New York Times and any of that. So if you're reading, people are reading the newspapers, they're contributing to their own mental illness. And back in 1852, actually, Henry David Thoreau, that very famous philosopher and moral statesman, example of moral courage, he said, "Do not read newspapers." So people should take that away from this message. If they're reading the newspapers, you're just contributing to your own mental illness. And that goes for all this other media that's out there, for the most part, with the exception of programs like your own.
Right.
So let's say, go back to the Congo, 1885, Henry Morton Stanley, who was a journalist for the New York Post, went into the Congo for King Leopold and set up this operation to begin exploiting the rubber and the ivory under the cover of a humanitarian operation to stop slavery. So King Leopold used the argument that he was stopping slavery in the Congo to phenomenally increase his own wealth, as well as the wealth of the state of Belgium from 1885 until 1908, when the protectorate, the Congo Free State, was taken away from Leopold due to the activism that brought to the world's attention that entire villages were being brutalized and massacred, and people's hands were being cut off if they didn't collect the quota of rubber or ivory, for example, that they were supposed to gather. And this is the same thing that we're seeing in Africa today. You've got a front put on by the West of so-called humanitarian concern, and at the very same time, many of the same organizations are exploiting Africa profoundly, whether these are bleeding heart, you know, do-gooders who go over there as a Doctors Without Borders doctor and hope to, you know, help a few people, or whether they're the big mining and mercenary corporations which work together, mining mercenary companies, to exploit and plunder and depopulate Africa. And people should ask. I mean, it's a really simple 1 + 1 = 2. Millions and millions of people dying on the African continent. It's not necessary. It's completely manufactured. It's a state of affairs which is designed to entrench and permanently create a system of inequality and control and access for the white folks, for the most part, white economies from the outside world. So that's the nature of what's going on in Congo. It began in 1895. We get the same thing today. And it's not just Congo, of course. If we go up to Darfur in Sudan, back in Khartoum, in 1897 or 87, somewhere around there, there was this Battle of Omdurman, where the journalist of the time who was covering it was the guy Winston Churchill, who became prime minister in England. He was working as a journalist at the time, and he covered the slaughter of thousands and thousands and thousands. We're talking 50 or 60,000 Sudanese people who were armed with only spears and bows and arrows kind of thing. They were mowed down with the Gatling gun. So that's where it all begins, and it's the same story today.
Right, right. And what is going on today? I mean, people in the intro, they heard me say that minimally we're looking at 10 million people who have been killed as a result of conflict that has been going on in Congo since the 90s and probably beyond that. It's for the nascent, individual that hasn't had much experience with this topic, and maybe for the first time, this number jumps out because people have been deluged with Darfur, and one life being lost innocently and needlessly is a tremendous loss that can never be recovered. And so we're looking at Darfur, and we hear different estimates from 300,000 to, I've heard some estimates of 700,000, 800,000. But then people hear, what, 10 million? 10 million? Like, how is that even possible that 10 million people have been killed in Congo, and I haven't heard about this? What's going on with that?
Sure. It's important to recognize that Darfur's in the news because the American public has been propagandized to be sensitive to the fact that there's something going on in Sudan, and the people are led to believe that it's this nasty government of Omar Bashir in Khartoum, who's perpetrating, genocide, for example, war crimes and crimes against humanity, against innocent people in Darfur. Well, there's a war going on. The United States, Israel, Belgium, Chad, Egypt, Eritrea, they're all involved. Uganda, they're all involved in this war for Darfur, for Sudan. It's basically about Sudan, and it's about all of these natural resources. And, for example, 3 or 4 years ago, there was the Save Darfur movement was crying 300,000 or even 500,000 people dead in Darfur. And this was put out by some propagandists like Eric Reeves, the professor of English at Smith College, who doesn't know anything about anything for the most part. And he's taking State Department information fed to him from Sudan, from some people we can talk about, who were also involved in the war, the so-called genocide in Rwanda, and helped manufacture that conflict, and taking this information and putting it out there through the mass media in a profound way to sensitize the American public to the idea that they need to stand up and do something. It doesn't matter what, just do something to stop this so-called genocide in Darfur. So now the Darfur thing started coming into the public consciousness around 2003, but the history is much deeper than that. And so on May 28, 2009, I'm looking at a Darfur story. This is today. And this Darfur story, the very last paragraph of this short story says, estimates of the resulting death toll range from 10,000 in Sudan, in Darfur, 10,000 according to Khartoum, the government of Bashir, to 300,000 according to the UN Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. Now, this is the next to the last paragraph in this story, when 2 years ago it was the first paragraph and it was 500,000 dead. So now they're not even willing to say any more than 10,000 according to Khartoum, who of course is biased, and 300,000 according to the UN, who, of course, is biased. but we're not supposed to believe that the UN is biased. So we, you know, in any case, we're talking 10,000 to 300,000. The numbers have been completely manipulated, and the public has been massaged to believe that this conflict in Darfur needs to be stopped, and we, the good saviors of the world, need to go in there and stop it. Well, the fact is, as you point out, there's over 10 million dead in the Congo if we start in 1996 when the United States invaded the Congo. The roots of that conflict begin as far back as 1980 with the invasion of Uganda by this guy, President Museveni, Yoweri Museveni, who's the president today, president for life, in this so-called democracy, Uganda, which is held up as this example of democracy and development in Africa. And that's because Museveni does exactly what the system wants. He gets his loans from the IMF, gets his loans from the World Bank. He operates with big private military corporations. He operates with big multinational corporations. It's all about private profit, death, despair, and destruction. And he's doing exactly what the system wants. Well, back in 1980, he invaded Uganda and overthrew the current government of the time. Alongside of Museveni was this guy, Paul Kagame, who today is president of Rwanda. From 1980 to 1985, Kagame and Museveni fought in the bush in Uganda and finally seized control with all of these other troops backed by powerful corporations from the West to take control of Uganda in 1985. Kagame, who's today president of Rwanda, became in 1985 Yoweri Museveni's and the government of Uganda, the new government of Uganda, became the director of military intelligence. And his role was to go around and capture people, to brutalize them, to take them to these safe underground safe houses and torture them and commit massacres, all kinds of nasty stuff. That's what Paul Kagame was responsible for in the 1980s. So in 1989, Kagame is training at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for the Pentagon. Now, this is a school of clandestine operations, psychological operations, and counterintelligence, counterinsurgency warfare. So this is dark stuff. This is not, you know, an army that goes in, builds a couple schools, and helps a few babies, and then makes the front page of the New York Times, which is basically what happened with the Kagame army. From 1990 to 1994, Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni sent in thousands and thousands of Ugandan troops backed by the intelligence establishment and the Pentagon and Israel, and they committed massive atrocities in Rwanda from 1990 to 1994.
Wow.
And in that time, they forced millions of people away from their homes. They committed massacres of Tutsis and Hutus and the Twa people, which are the indigenous people. They didn't care who they killed. Anybody in Rwanda was suspect because Paul Kagame's mission for the establishment, for the Pentagon, was to clear Rwanda of any resistance to setting up a U.S. protectorate for business. Big business. We're talking about oil, mining, Coca-Cola, defense. Big industries, the tourist industry, the gorilla, you know, the furry gorilla industry in Rwanda is one of their biggest industries. So is coffee for Starbucks.
Yes.
Starbucks is basically genocide coffee. But people need to understand that Kagame took over power in Rwanda by coup d'etat. The United States seized control. It won the war in 1994, and then it called it genocide and blamed everything on the losing army, which was the Hutus, the Hutu power structure under the former government. The International Criminal Tribunal has recently found that there was no organized genocide. There was no conspiracy to commit genocide. No one at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the ICTR, no one has ever been convicted of a conspiracy to commit genocide in Rwanda since 1994. The tribunal has been running. Not one case has been found because there are no lists. There was no organized genocide. There were thousands of acts of genocide by people fighting against this nasty invading rebel army backed by the Pentagon. And the U.S. media structure made it look completely upside down so that the people that were actually committing the atrocities were said to be the victims, meaning the Tutsis were said to be the victims, the sufferers. That was the rebel army, the Paul Kagame army who took power and is in power today. And the perpetrators supposedly were the Hutus. And so the whole thing was turned upside down. The Hutus are responsible for genocide. This is what the propaganda says. 100 days of genocide, Hutus killing Tutsis, everybody slaughtered by machetes and axes and sharp, you know, thorns in clubs kind of thing. Doesn't talk about the American weaponry that was sent in there, or the South African weaponry, or the Egyptian weaponry that came in from the United States, for example. And so from Rwanda in 1994, Kagame and his military henchmen moved into the Congo. And the first thing they did was they shelled these refugee camps in eastern Congo. So we have two, I didn't even mention one, but we have two major acts of war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide. One, the invasion of Rwanda from Uganda in 1990. It should have been stopped on the spot because it was a violation of a sovereign government. But
yeah.
Nobody said anything about it. They got away with absolute mass murder instead and overthrew the government and then, as I say, created this narrative about how the Hutus committed genocide. And Bill Clinton should have done something to stop it. And we're all morally corrupt because we didn't do anything to stop it. Well, this is the upside-down propaganda, and it's been peddled over and over by guys like Philip Gurevich in the New Yorker magazine. And Gurevich wrote this book, "We Regret to Inform You," or "We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow Our Families Will Be Killed." And it's seen as a piece of nonfiction, and it's total fiction. And we could get into, for example, Gurevich's connections to the State Department and who was feeding them the information and all the fabrications that were created to produce this propaganda. But let's go back to the major war crimes that were committed and have never been challenged, and no one's ever been held to account for these. The next major war crime was April 6, 1994, when the plane carrying the president of Rwanda, Juvenal Habyarimana, and the president of Burundi, and I think I always get confused, Cyprien Ntirimanda, I think, but in any case, the president of Rwanda and Burundi on April 6, 1994 were assassinated. Their plane was shot out of the sky over on approach to the airport in Kigali. That assassination has never been investigated. The
right.
United Nations, the U.S., they've all blocked the investigations of that plane crash. Now, the people in the world who know what's going on in Rwanda and Central Africa know perfectly well who did it. The Central Intelligence Agency backed a small clandestine cell of covert operatives, including Paul Kagame's military forces, and they shot down the plane, committed a double presidential assassination, knowing perfectly well that this was going to spark massive killing on both sides. And that is what has been, you know, the basis for this narrative about genocide in Rwanda. But there's never any holding anyone to account for shooting down the plane. In fact, when the media described it at the time, it was a, quote, mysterious plane crash, unquote. And people still say this in the American media. Instead of investigating, imagine if George Bush was killed in a plane crash over Washington and nobody investigated it. Or the president of, or the prime minister of Israel, or the president of some other U.S. friendly country. We'd be all over it.
And yeah.
That's a clue. People need to look at these clues and start thinking for themselves. But as I say, if you're reading this stuff in the New York Times or New Yorker or Atlantic Monthly or Harper's or In These Times or LA Times or Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, just contributing to your own mental illness. So the next bigger, big, massive war crime that was committed was the attacks against the refugee camps in eastern Congo in 1996. Now, these were camps that held millions of people from Rwanda who fled the U.S. invasion, the U.S.-backed invasion, because they knew perfectly well that Paul Kagame and his military troops, these crack U.S.-trained troops, were butchering people, massacring entire villages, and then they would blame it on the enemy. They would bring in the media, and this is exactly what's happening in Darfur. They bring in the media, and they point at a bunch of dead bodies, and they're black people, and they're just decaying bodies. You can't figure out who they are, whether they're Fur or Marsabit, or whether they're ethnic Hutu or Tutsis or Mai Mai or Mau Mau or any of the other names they might throw out, the system might throw out to confuse us. They're just dead people. You don't know who they are, but the media looks at them and says, and they point the fingers at them, and they say, these people were killed by President Bashir in Khartoum, and we need to hold him responsible for genocide. Or these people were killed by the government of Juvenal Habyarimana, and we need to charge the government of Habyarimana with genocide. In fact, in April 1996, there was no government of Rwanda. The entire government, the people that led the government had been killed in the plane crash, the military chief of staff, President Habyarimana, and several other key military officials. So anyway, Kagame invaded the Congo in 1996. They attacked the refugee camps, and they went about systematically slaughtering Hutu people. 80% of the refugees in Congo, in eastern, at that time it was Zaire under this guy Mobutu, and we could talk about that.
Yeah.
And 80% of the refugees were women and children. They were not armed FDLR, which is the Forces for the Democratic Liberation of Congo, who are today thrown about, this word FDLR is thrown about in the media everywhere as the people who were responsible for all the atrocities in Central Africa, as if they were the only military there. It's the same with Darfur, as if the government of Sudan was the only government involved in the war in Sudan. That's what the media makes it look like, as if the Janjaweed are killing people are only backed by the government of Sudan, and there's nobody else involved in the conflict. It's really odd how that happens. They call it a counterinsurgency attacks by the government of Khartoum, or the counterinsurgency attacks by the government of Rwanda. Well, who's the insurgency? The insurgency is the people you need to look at, these so-called rebels. Where do they come from? This is not an African phenomenon. These are people trained, organized by the outside, funded by military, funded by multinational corporations, powerful, powerful people, a list of which we can give the names. You know, white people with a lot of money and power in the world, like John Bredenkamp or Billy Rautenbach, two Zimbabwean, South African, British-connected guys who operate freely with the support of the United States, shipping weapons all around the place. Elwin Blattner in the Congo. Another guy is Louis Michel, the former EU commissioner. He has connections to the diamond trade in Congo.
Maurice Templeton, too.
And Maurice Templeton, yeah. So anyway, just to get back to this quick, quick opening here, the Kagame forces shelled the refugee camps, slaughtered 800,000 to 1.2 million Hutu people, completely defenseless and unarmed people, just chased them across the country, massacring them left and right, and the U.S. knew all about it. The world knew all about it, and they let it happen. And so that's where we need to start to understand what happened in Congo and what happened in Rwanda, because it all begins with Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni. Unless we go back a little further to this guy Mobutu, who was put in power in 1965 after we assassinated Patrice Lumumba. And the Mobutu era, you know, set the stage for the current plunder in Congo. And it involves, the plunder today involves many of the same people who were involved in the Mobutu era. And it's funny how the media has never investigated the Mobutu era. They dismissed the whole entire Mobutu era from 1965 to 1997 like this. Mobutu was a corrupt dictator. We should have done something, but we didn't. The CIA reportedly backed him, reportedly. And by the way, he's dead. We can't do anything about it. He destroyed the country, and, you know, that's the way it was.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you talk because, I can't help but think that just I'm hoping that listeners are just discursively, like, thinking in their head, like, you know, these guys, from Kagame to Museveni, they're both allies of the U.S. You don't ever hear the U.S. government castigating them or, you know what I'm saying, as they do with Kim Jong-il and whoever else that they, you know, Chavez, whoever else that they name, you know, enemy number one. And it's usually folks that have the balls to actually put the U.S. and check the U.S. in its place publicly, you know, and not to allow the U.S. to actually run roughshod through their country. But it's interesting, these folks have, you know, and I believe Museveni has more blood in his hands than Idi Amin ever had. And you don't hear a damn word out of the U.S., I've never heard anything from any kind of mainstream media outlet throughout the U.S. saying anything negative about Kagame or about Museveni. And what I want to know is, I know, but I think that maybe some listeners might not have an idea, like what is in the earth in Congo? What is so valuable? Why is there a mad rush? You say plunder. What sits in the soil in the Congo that makes it such an appealing project for thieves and murderers and folks who support them, such as, you know, as you said, the Pentagon, other, you know, multinational corporations that come from the U.S., that come from Canada, like Barrick Gold and Belgium and so forth. What's in the earth that makes it so valuable to rob and plunder?
Sure. Fantastic question. Before I mention the long short list of the world's primary resources that are coming out of the Congo and why they're so important to the world, it's important to note that the biggest industry in Congo, the biggest business, the biggest moneymaker for the Congo is not mining. It's not the combination of all these other things that I'm going to list all together. It's multinational humanitarian industry.
Huh.
It's the humanitarian industry. It's the humanitarian sector, the so-called humanitarian sector. It's private profit for refugees. It revolves around people and death and despair and destruction. It revolves around refugee camps. It's the entire NGO industry, the non-government organization industry. Aid, A-I-D, aid for Congo and suffering and poverty is the biggest business in Congo. And if you add up all these other massive industries that the United States and Israel and Australia and Belgium and France and et cetera, Canada especially, are after, you don't even still approach the number in terms of funds that comes to the Congo for these prophets in suffering and misery. So if we get beyond that, recognizing that, first of all, the creation of misery is the biggest business for the West in Congo and Sudan and Somalia and Uganda, where there's 2.1 million Acholi people forced onto these death camps by the government of Yoweri Museveni. The genocide in Uganda is one of the worst genocides in the world, and nobody knows about it for the most part. All these places where there's this refugees, and this thing we've come to think of as refugees without asking why or without understanding the real why, that's the big business. That's the big slaughter. That's the big depopulation. So then going next to the raw materials in the Congo, in 1895, rubber and ivory were the first big products coming out of the Congo. And then labor. Labor became a big source of, of course, we can't forget to mention slavery. So slaves coming out of the Congo served to build the Western capitalist genocidal establishment from the beginning, back in whatever, 14-something. They started ripping the slaves out of Congo, out of Africa, yeah? And it's important to note, there's a really important black African-American scholar named Ivan Van Sertima, who's published a fantastic series of books, one of them called They Came Before Columbus. This is about the trade between Africa and the Americas before the white man arrived. That's the history that people need to understand. And people need to understand, you know, Amos Wilson, when he writes about the colonization of our minds and how we need to decolonize our minds and the he wrote such a profound book, and I can't think of the name in this moment. But anyway, read Amos Wilson about this as well. So that's the beginning of the slaughter and the suffering and the ripping apart of Africa, is the ripping apart of families that set the stage for the plunder that followed under King Leopold. So rubber and ivory were first. By 1910, they had set up some other mining establishments in the Congo that were starting to pull out raw materials. In the 1920s, they set up these massive open pit mining operations, primarily for uranium and copper. Well, I take that back. Not even uranium, not yet, but copper. And now the copper belt in southern Katanga, in southern Congo, is connected to Zambia. And so the white man divided up Africa, of course, in 1885 in the conference in Berlin, such that Zambia is one state and Belgian Congo was another, and the copper belt was divided between the two, and they're controlled by different countries. But the copper belt runs across the lines there, Zambia and Congo, and it's full of copper and cobalt. So copper was big. As far as, 1970s, they were using the copper from Congo for the bullets in Vietnam. But it set the stage for these other, massive mining operations. Copper and cobalt are the big, 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 big business out of the Congo today after... Cobalt is the number one after the misery industry. Cobalt is used for planes, trains, automobiles, tank armor, ship hulls, oil derricks, undersea mining, aerospace and defense, nuclear weapons, and nuclear reactors. Anything that flies in outer space, anything that flies above, over our skies, anything that goes into the deep sea or down in the earth, blast furnaces, they all revolve around the raw material cobalt, which is essential for superalloys. So the entire military-industrial complex needs cobalt, and two-thirds of world supply is found in South Congo. And nobody talks about the cobalt. What they do talk about is coltan, Colombian tantalite. So when you see these people today who are supposedly activists concerned about the Congo, they're often talking about coltan and the cell phone technologies that use coltan, Colombian tantalite. Colombian tantalite was exported originally in the 1960s, the coltan mines in the Congo were controlled by Union Carbide. Union Carbide is an American multinational corporation who, of course, is responsible for the massive death and suffering and then running away and leaving a mess in Bhopal, India. So that's who we're operating with here, who we're talking about, nasty corporation. So Union Carbide controlled these coltan mines in 1960 in the Congo, in particular this one mine which has niobium, another raw material, columbium, tantalum, columbite, columbium, tantalite, all of these different names for the same basic substances. And you also find in the same mines or nearby, you find tin, cassiterite. These all are really important to the U.S. military today for very, very state-of-the-art radars and surveillance equipment and communications equipment that allows a U.S. military guy to have these really intense, sophisticated communications devices in his headset or on his body armor. And then they're used in all kinds of aerospace and defense, and they're used in the new emerging secretive emerging sector called nanotechnology. And just to mention, for your listeners here, I have a master's degree in electrical engineering, and I used to work for GE Aerospace in their defense electronics laboratory. So I know what this is about. It's all very secretive stuff. It's all very state of the art. We won't learn how they're using this stuff. A lot of it is in black programs, which are funded secretly by the Pentagon or for the Pentagon, and even the Congress isn't told what these black programs are about. So this stuff is coming into the United States: the coltan, the niobium, the germanium and selenium. These are rare earths. They're very important to charge storage devices, and charge storage devices make it possible for you to have an iPod, or for me to have a cell phone, or for all of us to have a Sony PlayStation or a laptop computer, or any of this other stuff. And this is all in the public sector. Imagine what they're doing in the defense sector, where they produce this weaponry we don't have a clue about. And that's why they need this stuff. And that's why you've got these people running around, these so-called activists running around complaining about the minerals trade coming out of eastern Congo. The coltan is eastern Congo. The niobium and the selenium and the germanium, these are all eastern Congo. And the whole point that it's in the news is only because the U.S. corporations want to control that stuff. So when a U.S. activist, when these activists stand up and say, we have to stop the blood mineral trade out of the Congo, they're only making it possible by passing U.S. legislation and sending in the Pentagon, sending in forces, for example. They're only making it possible for certain corporations to make a killing. And as long as those corporations make a killing, whether it's Bechtel or OM Group, which is in Ohio, or Cabot Group, or some Japanese corporation, or some corporation connected to the New York Times, as long as these particular corporations are making a killing, the story will disappear if they are. But as long as somebody else has control of these mines, then the story is going to stay alive because they want to force these people out. And so you've got these activists running around making testimony before Congress, but they don't say anything about the American corporations that are already there, for example, like Banro Corporation. Right. But back to the raw materials in the Congo. How about diamonds? In 1960, Maurice Templespan set up the diamond trade, basically out of the Congo. Now, who is Maurice Templespan? You mentioned him earlier. Templespan is the former lover of Jackie Kennedy Onassis, who died in 1994. Templespan in the 1960s was very close to the Kennedy family, to John Kennedy, to Robert Kennedy. And in the 1960s, Adlai Stevenson, for example, was one of the lawyers who I think his firm worked with Templespan. Templespan was directly connected to covert operations in Congo and Ghana that led to the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. And this guy, Templespan, is currently on the scene involved in the diamond trade in Congo, Sierra Leone, Botswana, Angola, Central African Republic, and Liberia. And Templespan's connections are very deep to the Clintons, for example. They sail off Martha's Vineyard on their yachts together.
Right.
And Templespan had this network of diamond dealers and military CIA officials, like this very famous CIA guy, Lawrence Devlin, who ran the CIA chief of station in Lubumbashi, which is the heartland of the cobalt and the diamonds and the copper in southern Congo. You find the diamonds, the big diamonds in Congo, used for industrial purposes. These diamonds are important for cutting, also for the military and defense establishment, for the defense establishment, military-industrial complex. The industrial diamonds are a huge, huge business. Maurice Templespan is also on the board of the Harvard AIDS Institute, and black people should worry about that. Harvard AIDS Institute, HIV/AIDS. What is Maurice Templespan, this diamond guy, doing on the board of the Harvard AIDS Institute, and what is their affiliation with, for example, the diamond legislation that supposedly made all diamonds clean diamonds these days? It was called the Kimberley Process. Well, that was organized out of Harvard as well. And Templespan's AIDS Institute connections also connect to a Pentagon military program in HIV/AIDS technologies. Let's call them technologies. But what we're really talking about is biowarfare. And we're talking, again, you know, look at the numbers of people that are dying in Africa. This is not a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's very real. And you know, you can make these connections for yourself. Look at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and you find out that Maurice Templespan is one of the trustees. Now, what's Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute about? Well, Jacques Cousteau and a few sharks and, you know, making sure the oceans, the wonderful oceans, National Geographic specials on TV and all that nonsense. The fact is, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute makes it possible for Maurice Templespan to mine the diamonds offshore of Congo, Republic of Congo, Namibia, and Angola, which is a big, big business, ripping up the seabed for undersea diamonds. So this guy Templespan is very close to the establishment. He's the number one funder of the Democratic Party.
Wow.
He's been very, very close. He funded Barack Obama when he was a senator in Colorado. Was it Colorado? Where was Obama a senator? See how much?
Illinois.
No. Whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, Templespan's been all over the Congo since the 1960s, and he still is. He's still all over Africa. He should be brought to trial by the International Criminal Tribunal. He should be the first person on the block regarding Africa. But instead, they've arrested five black men and charged, you know, so-called warlords, and charged them with war crimes. And these are just the fall guys for the Templespans of the world, you know?
Yeah.
So what else does Congo? Congo also has petroleum, massive petroleum in the heartland, massive petroleum on the west coast, which would be the Atlantic Ocean, and massive petroleum on the border between Uganda, Sudan, and Rwanda. There's also natural gas. So petroleum is a big, big business, coming business for Congo. And also the rubber plantations were eventually converted also to include cocoa, coffee, rubber, and palm oil. So these plantations are a massive business in Congo, where there's approximately 100,000 slave laborers working on these plantations for white guys who own these plantations. And nobody's done a story about that. And then, what did I forget? Water. The Congo River is the second largest river basin in the world, and it's clean. You know how important that is to the world?
Yes.
Somebody's after the water.
Yes.
It won't be long before these corporations pollute it, but that's a different question.
Yeah, exactly.
So those are the big raw materials coming out of Congo. Oh, and uranium. In 1930s, uranium was brought from the Congo out of Chinkalobwe and used for the atomic weapons that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Right.
So the uranium in the Congo is a big business as well. And the corporations that are in control, these include Phelps Dodge, and as I mentioned, Union Carbide was there in the 1960s. I don't think they're there now, but there's a company called Metallurg, which is connected to both in New York and Pennsylvania, and OM Group in Ohio, and Cabot Corporation, and all the big oil companies, Exxon Mobil. There's a lot of little oil companies, Heritage Oil and Gas, that are connected to mercenary companies. And then there's a company called Moto Gold, and I didn't even mention the gold. The Kilomoto gold mines, you know, we could call them King Solomon's mines, except there was no Solomon here. The Kilomoto gold mines in Congo are said to be coming online with more gold than any other gold mine in Africa. And these are controlled today by a group of small companies like Moto Gold. And Moto Gold has on its board of directors another guy who should be brought up on war crimes, a guy named Walter Kansteiner. And it turns out that Walter Kansteiner was National Security Council under William Jefferson Clinton during the war and the invasion of Congo and the subsequent invasions and war. And then Kansteiner was also involved with the national security apparatus for George Walker Bush. Kansteiner today is on the board of Moto Gold and also on the board of the African Wildlife Foundation, which puts another front on this whole story about primates, gorillas, and chimpanzees, and bonobos, and rare white rhinoceroses up in the northeast of Congo. And all the other, you know, conservation interests that bring in the massive exploitative Western conservation establishment, all these institutions that people want to believe are fantastic and you know, have put their faith in, like the Jane Goodall Institute or the Dian Fossey Gorilla Fund or World Wildlife Fund. This is all just Western exploitation and white supremacy. Going back to Moto Gold and Walter Kansteiner, today Moto is in control of some big, big gold mines in the Congo, and the people have, you know, there's vast fields of skeletons around the Moto gold mines, and they're using USAID, the American arm of the State Department, so-called Aid Administration, USAID, Agency for International Development. They're using USAID funds to build their runway so they can ship the raw materials out without having to go through the war zone. They also obviously are connected to the weaponry, but nobody ever does any research about this, and newspapers never mention a guy named Walter Kansteiner. You'll never see him mentioned, ever, ever, ever. Especially from the so-called activists who are supposedly interested in stopping the massive rape in the Congo, for example.
Yeah.
So that was a mouthful. I should shut up and let you talk. Another white guy going on, yeah?
No, it's perfect. And I know some of my comrades who are tuning in right now, this is vastly important. And so, I definitely want you to do the majority of talking. I'll just throw the questions out there. And, I mean, that was – that was more than a mouthful, but that was exactly what was needed because that's, I mean, for people that are just tuning in right now, I mean, that's more than they've ever gotten about Congo in a very, you know what I'm saying, connect the dots, sequential type of way that makes so much sense. And it should make sense to people that are listening with a critical mind's eye. And you mentioned some of these so-called activists, you know, these nitwits such as like John Prendergast and these folks with Save Darfur. And for folks who don't know about Save Darfur, myself and especially Keith may have pinned you right now because Save Darfur is a piece of crap, and so is the work that John Prendergast is doing. And I was wondering if you can you know, tell us why folks like John Prendergast, who gets so much play from the U.S. media. I mean, he's on everything from MSNBC. He's been, you know, just even this year, congressional hearing or Senate hearings on genocide, and he's spoken about child soldiering and this, that, and the other. He's spoken about Uganda and Congo and definitely about Darfur. He's everywhere. And I know, you know, that he's a piece of crap, and you do too, but the listeners might not know, and they might not know about Save Darfur. And I think that also, if you can tie in, you know, the role that white supremacy plays, because there are people, I mean, as you know, there's some honest groups here, such as Friends of the Congo, that are doing some great, great work to try to get the word out here. There was a International Congo Week last semester, or last year in October, that, you know, I got some of my students on the campus of University of Maryland involved, and there's many, many folks across the globe that were involved in trying to get the word out about what's going on in the Congo, and that was all, you know, led by the efforts of folks that work within Friends of the Congo. I know you've been doing a tremendous job. You've been in the continent. You've been to Congo numerous times. How does white supremacy play a role to this obliviousness that we see? Because it just seems like no matter how hard, you know, we try to get the word out, it seems to fall upon deaf ears. It seems that people here in the U.S. just don't get it. They're like, oh, that's so terrible. All those black people are dying and this, that, and the other. But it seems to be no massive groundswell to push, to make a dent, to stop, you know, our government and the multinational corporations that exist within the United States of America to stop what they're doing. They're fueling this. And I know you'll talk about the complicity, like, you know, groups like Doctors Without Borders has played with this slavery plantation story that you've just, you know, unearthed. And that's something I definitely want you to talk about. But John Prendergast, Save Darfur, white supremacy, obliviousness, false propaganda. What is this all about?
Obliviousness. You picked the key word, obliviousness. Oblivious people being oblivious, unconscious. All of us are unconscious at some level about something or other, you know? I mean, I'm totally unconscious about a lot of things in the world. And at the same time, you know, I like to think that I'm conscious and I want to believe that I'm conscious. So if somebody comes along and says, I don't know what I'm talking about, of course, my first reaction is to be egotistical and fight.
Right.
And if I get beyond that and I'm an honest guy, I'll probably come back. I might, if I don't fight immediately and I'm willing to open my mind and say, hey, no, not many people stop and say, hey, you know, you're right, I'm wrong. And that's what we got. The problem we got here with most white people is they'll never say that, you know. We're talking about big white business. We're talking about white economies of controlling the debate, controlling the narratives about what's going on in Africa. So, for example, John Prendergast and the Enough Project, which he founded, Enough is supposed to mean we've had enough genocide, you know, enough slavery, enough genocide, whatever. You go to look at what they're writing about on their website about when Prendergast just appeared before the Congress, confronting rape and other forms of violence against women in conflict zones, for example. He doesn't mention anything about the corporations. He does, but it's in such a way that it makes it look like they're concerned about the corporations and that they're challenging the corporations when, in fact, they have no intention of ever challenging the corporations. It will just support and entrench a system of white control and white power. So obliviousness is the key term, and that's something that I've come into consciousness about by reading a book called Race and Epistemologies of Ignorance. Now, whiteness and white supremacy, whiteness is a state of mental illness, because white people have completely projected themselves as the superior people on the planet. So let's stick to the European, Western, American, Canadian economies and populations. And white people in these populations have completely projected the idea that we're superior. The narrative has been going since before, long before Columbus's time, that the white Western civilization is, you know, civilization. It's educated. It's enlightened. Meanwhile, you know, you've got these people from the conquistadors just absolutely butchering people, with the priests looking on and basically blessing them. And it's the very same thing going on in Congo today with a guy, you know, with a guy that's there. For example, there's this minister in South Sudan, or in Congo, these missionaries. There's this one minister who runs around with an AK-47, and the media in America makes him out to be a hero. You know, they've mixed up God and militarism. This is white supremacy. We want to believe that we're the best. We want to believe that we're honest. We want to believe that we're good. We want to believe our society is just. We don't want to look at our white supremacy. We definitely don't want to look at our genocide. Or I should say, we don't want to look at our genocide, and we definitely don't want to look at our white supremacy. You start talking white supremacy, and white people really crawl under the rug. It makes them crawl out of their skin, but that's exactly what needs to happen. People need to be made uncomfortable for what's going on. But you've got all these people out there that don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. Meanwhile, they won't say anything about the slaughtering of 10 million people in the Congo, you know? So the ignorance of white supremacy is an ignorance by choice. It's like that powerful black American man said, and I can't think of his name at the moment, but it's such an important statement. It's the very ignorance that is the crime. It's ignorance. We don't want to know. We don't know. We don't want to know. It's not, we don't know, and tell us. It's, we don't want to know. And it's also the arrogance that we don't have to know. You know, it's not my business. It's none of my business that people are being slaughtered in the Congo. It's none of my business. Who are you anyway? You know, there's so much arrogance in white people and in our society. And it's not just white people. You know, there's plenty of people, but certainly in white people. So that's the nature of whiteness and white supremacy. And white and Africa has been projected as this basket case since the beginning, since Heart of Darkness. It's hopeless. It's heartless. It's Africans with Ebola and disease, and it's the nature of Africa. People fight and kill each other there. They're savages. They kill each other with machetes. In Iraq, the American military may slaughter an entire village with a single bomb, but there's something civilized about that in these narratives, you know? They wouldn't ever compare the narrative of how we kill people with massive military equipment or robots today in Afghanistan with how people fight against each other in Africa, for example. So that's the nature of the system. It's completely, the propaganda is very deep and entrenched, and the system knows perfectly well that it can use these sound bites and these jingoisms and these stereotypes of the savage African man right out of Tarzan. Tarzan is the white hero, and he's got his lovely Jane. Well, there's Jane Goodall, or there's Diane Fossey, or there's Mia Farrow, the white actress who's on a hunger strike to protest the killing in Darfur by that nasty government of Sudan. This is a disgusting form of white supremacy. But it's just one form. It's just one piece of it. The worst part is the fascism, the mass psychology of fascism, which allows the American public, who would otherwise be concerned and would be willing to address their whiteness, to be part of this system of devastation and not challenge their own interests. Because that's what it comes down to. It's about interests. Somebody's making some money somewhere. You know, as soon as your interests are threatened, or as soon as you're going to lose some money as an individual, or something's going to offend you or make you look bad, people fight, and they don't want to challenge their interests. They become dumb. They become blind.
Right.
And this is a studied, open, honest blindness, dishonest blindness, I mean. You know, it's an absolute, I'm going to be blind. And that's the nature of John Prendergast. John Prendergast was National Security Council under William Jefferson Clinton at the same time as Walter Kanzsteiner. And I don't think I mentioned this, but Walter Kanzsteiner's father, Walter Kanzsteiner III is the one who is running this gold mine in the Congo. He's one of the directors. But his father was a coltan trader out of Chicago. So that's the coltan connection again. So Kanzsteiner's interests are very deep. In 1996 or 1997, at the very same time as the Rwandan and Ugandan and U.S. military were marching across the Congo, Kanzsteiner made a speech about how we need to divide Congo up into small states. And that's exactly what they're trying to do now, balkanize the Congo and control it with multinational corporations. And Prendergast, he's this guy who runs around in a pair of tennis shoes, you know, red tennis shoes, He looks like an ordinary guy with a long coat, you know, presents himself as this innocent activist kind of guy, but he's complicit. He's National Security Council during the invasion of Rwanda and Congo. He's got blood all over himself. He was also behind some of the military orchestrations by Clinton against Sudan in the late 1990s, like the attack against the Al-Shifa Pharmaceutical Corporation, which they claimed was producing weapons of mass destruction or biowarfare or something like that, you know?
That they bombed, yeah.
That they bombed. That was Sudan's number one source of medical supplies for the public.
Right.
And the death toll from the absence of lack of medical supplies at this point is we don't have a clue. But nobody's ever going to report that fairly either. Anyway, this is John Prendergast. He goes around making these statements before Congress like this one. There is clearly no silver bullet solution to the conflict in eastern Congo. This is his testimony to Congress last week. However, the international community and regional actors, blah, 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 blah. It's just nonsense. And then down below, he says that in Congo, there's a few militias running the mining trade that need to be routed. We need to get these militias out of the Congo. This is code. And the language is code for there are big corporations that want these supplies, and we can't get at them until we get these militias and armies warring over conflict minerals out of the Congo. So this is exactly what Prendergast said, quote, sexual violence in Congo is often fueled by militias and armies warring over conflict minerals, the ores that produce tin, tungsten, and tantalum. Armed groups from Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda finance themselves through illicit conflict mineral trade and fight over control of mines and taxation points inside Congo. That is complete nonsense. It's true only so much as the falsification of African consciousness is true, meaning it's true, but it's not the truth. It's just a very little piece of the truth. There are mining militias all over the Congo. I mean, there's been 28 or 30 or 35 militias that have been created since 1996, and it's a massive joke on the American public. All of these militias with their names, like the FDLR, or the FNI, or the UCPD, or the DPCC, or the RCD Goma, or the RCD Kisangani. It's just an alphabet soup to confuse the public. These are just military gangs that are set up by powerful factions from the outside. The corporations are running the war. So Banro Corporation, it's a Canadian company. They operate in South Kivu in eastern Congo, right on the border with Rwanda, and they control these massive concessions. But you don't ever hear John Prendergast say the word Banro. John,
never.
Hello, it's a very simple word to spell, B-A-N-R-O. Banro, hello, how about Moto Gold? How about Moana Africa? How about Barrick Gold Corporation?
Yeah.
George Herbert Walker Bush was the special advisor to Barrick Gold, and in 1996, George Herbert Walker Bush, who was then, not the president, but was still a very powerful man, made a telephone call to Mobutu, and he told him, I think, he said, basically, you're out. Unless you do this, this, and this. And then immediately, the U.S. forces backed the Rwandan-Ugandan invasion because Mobutu wasn't about to do what George Bush said. And George Bush was calling for a guy named Adolf Lundin, this powerful guy from Sweden who's got all these other mining and petroleum companies in Sudan and in Congo and in other countries, and other continents as well. And Barrick has been responsible for massacres and atrocities in other countries as well and other continents. And currently, for example, in Madagascar, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Tanzania, and the Congo, Barrick is associated in Africa with Anglo-American Corporation. And Anglo-American is this big gold corporation that began back in the, again, with Cecil Rhodes, back in South Africa in the 1800s. And Anglo-American is connected to the De Beers conglomerate, the De Beers family. And De Beers is the company that Maurice Templespan worked for with his diamonds. He traded through De Beers and through all these other corporations. Getting back to John Prendergast, hello, John, he doesn't mention any of these groups.
Never.
He gives you absolute nonsense. It's called making it look like you know what you're talking about and making people, giving them a, what we would call a snow job, but never really telling you anything at all. And that's why he's covered everywhere. Anytime anybody out there who's listening sees somebody in the media everywhere, you got to say to yourself, this is not an activist. This is the establishment. And the more, the more that they appear in a magazine like In These Times or The Nation or something, or Mother Jones or something that appears to be leftist or progressive or alternative, it's another clue that there's something going on, because these magazines are just about private profit. They're about selling pages. They're about selling copy. They're not about telling you the truth. So that's the nature of that, you know, little animal. I mentioned that guy, Amos Wilson. His book is called The Falsification of African Consciousness. It's a very small, very, very important book, and everybody should read it. The Falsification of African Consciousness, Eurocentric History, Psychiatry, and the Politics of White Supremacy. It's a great book. And that's
very
what we're talking
book.
About here. We're talking about mental illness, and we're talking about interests. And John Prendergast gets a salary. And the Enough organization, Enough, and all of these other Enough clones that I call Save Darfur clones, they get a lot of money, and nobody ever tells you where it comes from. The Save Darfur movement gets a lot of money. We're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars in salaries. And it's involving Jewish and American so-called philanthropies and all of these organizations that have interests. Everybody has interests. And you got to look behind them and find out who are the people that set up the Save Darfur movement. That would be the Center for American Progress. And the Center for American Progress also set up the Enough Project.
Right.
And the Center for there's another one that's behind the Save Darfur movement and all this propaganda, and it's a very deep, dark animal. So there are some think tanks that have manufactured this propaganda, manipulated the public into becoming activists in the kind of way that there was the anti-apartheid movement. They're trying to use the American public, good-meaning people like you, me, and everybody else, not George Bush, not Bill Clinton, not John Prendergast, to help Africa, when really what they're doing is making sure that corporations are going to be in control in the end. American corporations, Israeli corporations.
Right.
So.
And, man, that was another great mouthful. There's some research that you just you spent countless hours researching. You've been on location, you've seen it with your own eyes, and this was you know, something that has to do with slavery plantations that exist right now, not in 1898, but right now in 2009, 2008. You said that there are slavery plantations in Congo, and that there are organizations such as Borders, Doctors Without Borders, that know about these slavery plantations, because they've set up near them and have been complicit, you know, by shutting their mouth and not reporting what they saw. What are these slavery plantations? What's going on, and who's connected to them?
Yeah, absolutely. The plantations in Congo, there's two big plantation holders that I'm aware of, and I know there's others, but these are the two big names that I know. George Forrest, one of the biggest manipulators of the Congo and, you know, war criminals in the history of humanity. And George Forrest is the guy that owns this company, OM Group, O, capital O, capital M Group, and that's in Ohio. And that's getting cobalt out of and coltan out of the Congo. And George Forrest is also involved in aviation in Congo and in Africa and shipping weapons. He has weapons factories in, I think there's one in Kenya, and he had one in Belgium at one point. And George Forrest, his family, has been involved in the mining in the Congo since 1920, and at some point they set up these plantations, and it may have been before 1920, I'm not sure. And the forest plantations are one big set competitive business of plantations in coffee, cocoa, rubber, and palm oil. I think those are the big ones. Coffee, cocoa, rubber, palm oil, and tea. And there's a couple others, but those are the big ones. And one of the competitors of George Forrest and another guy that's involved in plantations is a family named Blattner. The Blattner family is a Jewish family out of Bayonne, New Jersey, and they also have passports, and they have properties in both Belgium and Israel and in Congo. And James Blattner went into the Congo at some point, I think it was, I'm guessing, because this I've been able to pinpoint it only so close as this, to say that sometime in the 1980s, James Blattner was operating in the Congo. But the plantations that he was controlling include some of the ones that were set up under Henry Morton Stanley in the heart of dark, in the so-called heart of darkness, and one of these is called Busira Lomami. So in terms of the total number of plantation slaves, the way I would put it is plantation slaves on these two big owners, the Blattner Group and the Forrest Group, each one owns about 6 to 8 plantations, something like that. The Blattners own 6, and each plantation has approximately 20,000 people working directly on the plantation. Sorry, each plantation has about 6,000 people working directly on the plantation. So for Blattner, it's a total of about 24,000 people. And the forest groups, if he has six plantations, he must have about 30,000 or 20,000 people as well. And this doesn't include the networks that supply the goods and supply, take the goods away, and all the river transport that they control, and all the aviation that they control, and all the construction and road building that they control, and all of the other things that they're getting in their hands more and more on, big mining, other mining products, you know. And the plantations in eastern Congo, in central Congo, controlled by the Blattner group, for example, James Blattner has three sons, Elwin Blattner and David Blattner and Daniel Blattner. Elwin Blattner is the guy who runs the plantations. David is involved in construction and other things. Elwin's plantations, again, have about 20,000 people, and the people are living under the most horrid conditions. It's just like 1890, except they don't have the audacity to cut people's hands off. They do it in other ways. Mm. And the people in Congo live to be about 40 years old, men and women. Jeez. They're dying of all kinds of treatable diseases that are defined as HIV/AIDS so that some pharmaceutical corporation can make a lot of money, or the NGO, who's the middleman, can make a lot of money by coming up with large numbers of people who have supposedly have HIV/AIDS, when in fact all they have is something that they're getting on these plantations, like tuberculosis or malnutrition or river blindness or yellow fever or malaria, all of these things that contribute to a complete destruction of your immune system. And that's why they're immediately defined as HIV/AIDS patients, and the numbers are manipulated to get funding from the outside world, including William Jefferson Clinton's AIDS Foundation that provides funding supposedly for AIDS research and AIDS patients or AIDS industry in Africa. And that's how the cycle of white supremacy goes round and round. But getting back to the plantations, Busiro Lomami, for example, has about 6,000 workers. There's a paramilitary, there's military, there's police. Anytime anybody does anything that might be considered to be a protest against the conditions or against the absolute misery, or against the maltreatment by the administration, the management, they call in the police. First, they pay off the governor. A $10,000 packet will be shipped off to the governor immediately, and the governor will then send in the police or the military to quell any kind of a protest on these plantations. So it's a militarized situation from the outset. The plantation, the people that run the plantation at the highest levels are involved in all kinds of sexual violence against, in many cases, we're talking about black managers against black women who are absolutely destitute. But this is, you know, there's these layers and levels and hierarchies of power and suffering, where on the very bottom you have the manual laborer who goes out into the fields every day, works his butt off, quite literally. They're skinny, they're dying, they're nothing to eat, there's manioc leaves for the most part, they're not getting the proper nutrients, they can't complain, they can't even carry the food onto them to work on the plantation for the day, because in some cases the administration doesn't allow that. They don't have enough water. And if this guy dies, his family will be booted out of the plantation housing if he's been provided plantation housing. In some cases, they're living in plantation housing that was built back in the 1920s. It's all crumbling. It's quite literally crumbling. They have nothing inside, a wooden thing you might call a table. When I went into the plantations, I took with me chocolate bars that were produced in Belgium from the cocoa that came off the plantations. And so there should be a protest against these Belgian chocolate makers, which is basically the cocoa coming out of Busiro Lomami. But the people had never seen chocolate in their entire life. They didn't even know what it was. They'd heard of it. But they'd never tasted cocoa. They'd never tasted chocolate, even though the beans are produced right there. So I pulled out a chocolate bar that I bought in on the airplane in the tax-free section. I said, wait a minute, that's the chocolate coming out of Busiro Lomami. So I took a couple of these chocolate bars in, and I shared them with the people, and they were astounded. You know, there are these fancy packages. The chocolate bars sell for $9 a piece in the United States. And they don't know anything about it. They don't see any of this. And they work for approximately $3 a month.
Jeez.
That is not a typo. And I'm not insane. They're getting $3 a month. And you can't live on that. And they don't. You can't even justify. What could you do with $3 a month? Does that mean that everything that they buy is like pennies? Well, there's nothing to buy. They don't have to worry about that. If in 10 years, one guy that we interviewed wasn't able to accumulate anything, nothing. He didn't even have shoes. Didn't have a bicycle, didn't have a TV, never used a cell phone, never mind a regular telephone. Hmm. Didn't have anything in his house, nothing. And this is after 10 years of absolute, brutal, 7 days a week labor, 8 to 10 or 12 hours a day. And if he misses a minute, he's docked. And if he's docked to a certain degree, he'll be fired, or his pay will be reduced. And how can you reduce your pay when it's only $3 a month? And they have a whole system what makes it slavery is it's this economic system whereby, for example, there are 5,000 workers, but 4,000 of them are daily workers. They're called daily workers, and only 1,000 of them are ever put on a contract. And the people who are put on a contract, they're fired, their contract's dissolved, they're made into daily workers again. And this is how they manipulate the people. All kinds of incentives, we might call them, which would otherwise be known as threats. And the paramilitary, for example, they're wearing brand new equipment provided by the international community for the elections in Congo in 2006. So these guys, the plantation security is running around in these RoboCop suits. And you know, the levels of injustice are profound. Let's talk about vitamin A. Vitamin A comes from palm nuts. Palm nuts come from the plantation. If you have any palm nuts in your house and the company finds them, they will beat you. They will rape the women. They will take the palm nuts, and they will fire you. Yeah. Vitamin A comes from palm nuts, and children under 5 need vitamin A to keep them healthy. There's no other source of – it's the main source of vitamin A in the rainforest. Instead of allowing the people to use the vitamin A from the plantation, what they do is they have Doctors Without Borders, or they have the UN come in with some big vaccination campaign where some pharmaceutical corporation like Pfizer, connected to Condoleezza Rice, has provided the vaccination for vitamin A, whatever it's called. And then they go around and they shoot up 1,000 kids across a huge stretch of the country. But, you know, there's 5 million kids. They're not even beginning to touch the population. And in the plantations area, it's so remote anyway, they don't have the vaccination campaign there. And that's how the vitamin A, you know, that's just another example of how the system manipulates and controls the people. Keep them sick. You keep them destitute. You keep them desperate. So that it's every man, quite literally, every man for himself, he will cut his own brother's throat to get the job that he needs to feed his family with. And then, if he can, he'll take care of his brother and his father and his mother and his extended family, and then it'll stretch out to his closest friends. And this is seen as corruption in the West, but it's absolute survival in the Congo. And the guy at the top, Maurice Templespan, or Elwin Blattner, who sits in an office in Kinshasa and is a member of this Jewish community that has these special bar mitzvahs where they fly people in at the cost of $50,000, you know, for a bar mitzvah. This is the nature of the injustice. And nobody's written about these plantations. Nobody. And they've been going since 1895.
It's almost like a rhetorical question, but I'm assuming the reason why people don't write about this is because the people that are financing these plantations are people from the West that are also Caucasian, white. Because best believe that if it was, you know, a black person, you know, financing this, and you know, especially if it was a black person that was the head of a state. In Africa, it would be blasted all over the place. This guy is he's violating human rights and this, that, and the other. But it's appalling. It's abhorrent. It's reprehensible, and it's infuriating to hear you speak this information, and to put it into context, and to talk about the folks that are financing this and
Not just financing. The white guys that run the plantations in Congo, George Forrest and Elwin Blattner, for example, are there. They're financing, they're running, they've got the control of the river networks. Elwin Blattner doesn't go to the plantations himself. He sends a guy from Belgium or a guy from France who he's paying a huge salary to be the plantation slave, what I call the slave driver. Now, this one guy that was a slave driver in Busiri Lomami, and he would travel around to the 6 big plantations that Blattner Group has in Congo. And these are vast tracts of land. We're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of acres of concessions in big parts of the country. And by the way, Elwin Blattner also controls logging, and these are huge concessions of logging that they've ripped up the land. They're ripping out the trees at a value of approximately $10,000 per log, and the people are living like, you know, quite literally living like animals in the same areas they've been forced out of. And WWF is right there, the World Wildlife Fund, and they know exactly what's going on, but they support the logging company. And they call it, you know, clean logging. They have a different term for sustainable forestry.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Doctors Without Borders on the plantations. I didn't really get into that, but they were set up right next to one of these plantations in a place called Basankusu in western Congo. And Doctors Without Borders had been there since 1992. And I met a Doctors Without Borders professional from Belgium, and she told me the story, and she was heartbroken. She had given her life to humanitarianism, And she came to realize that she'd been in Congo only for about 3 or 4 months, and she just couldn't stay because it was unethical and it was immoral what Doctors Without Borders was doing. And so she laid out all the ways that Doctors Without Borders was actually contributing to the problem and abusing the people of the Congo in this on these plantations. And, for example, they knew perfectly well that the sickest people were coming from the plantations, but they never said anything about it. The unhealthiest children were coming from the plantations, not from the villages where there were no plantations and no capitalist interests. They were coming from the plantations, where the owners of the plantations are claiming they've got health care and they've got, you know, clinics and they've got schools and they've got good housing and all this stuff that the white journalists don't go in and tell the truth about. And it's really true that it's just about it really is about the whiteness and the power. Because Elwin Blattner is a powerful man in the Congo. He's very close to the current government. During the war, he was funding both sides. He was shipping out his raw materials. He'll claim that the war, you know, caused him all this suffering and loss of, and he couldn't feed his workers and all this nonsense. That's only to get more money from the World Bank, so he doesn't have to fund his own operations from his own pocket when he's making 90% profit to begin with. It's completely upside down. Anyway, the journalists are white, mostly. They're completely indoctrinated to a system which goes in and looks at what people call a school in the Congo and clap their hands and say, oh, these children have a school. It's a shell. It's got a rusty roof and a couple of pieces of wood that they call desks and something on the wall that's black, supposedly created to be the chalkboard. They call it a school. The white people come in and applaud. They put it on the news and say that Elwin Blattner gave these people a school. I'm trying not to use the word I want to use because we're on radio. It's a scandal. It's a scandal. No, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the biggest. But people got to see through this. You know, you got to see through. And it's so entrenched that people are on. There's so few reports out there that are honest that it's really impossible for the American public to see through their own indoctrination and white supremacy. Even if we're talking about what Amos Wilson talks about, where the black man takes on the white system's constructs, the white system, like the Matrix. It's just like the movie The Matrix. It doesn't matter what skin color you got. If you're part of this system and you want to succeed in this system, you got to do what the system says. You got to pay your taxes. You know, you got to go to school. You got to get an education. You got to become indebted in the system of bondage that makes school your whole life become about paying back $60,000 or $100,000 worth of school loans. Yeah. When you know perfectly well that slavery is all around the world. I mean, in Haiti and Dominican Republic, two other disaster areas where slavery is going on in the same way. You know, people are hesitant to call it slavery in the same way that they're hesitant to call it genocide all over Africa. But we've got genocide in Botswana, where the San Bushmen are being killed for diamonds, being forced off their lands to places they call, a place called Nuzadu, for example, that they know as places of death. And Clinton and Templespan are all over the diamonds coming out of Botswana as well. And then there's genocide in all over the Congo, and then there's genocide in, there certainly is genocide in Darfur, but not as we know it. In other words, all of these black populations around Africa, by the definition of genocide, it is genocide. But the system only uses the label genocide when it serves the system to manipulate someone. So we label it genocide in Darfur and point the finger at Bashir, the president of Khartoum. We label it genocide in Rwanda and we point the finger at the people that we were fighting against, the Hutus. We label it genocide in Vietnam in 1975 and claim that it was that nasty red Chinese guy named Pol Pot. When meanwhile, from 59 or 61 to 1972 or whatever the dates were, we were carpet bombing Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
Cambodia, yeah.
And that's genocide. And genocide committed against the people in Japan. But you know, the Genocide Convention, people are so scared to talk about this genocide thing. The Genocide Convention was gutted. The way it was actually written by this Polish jurist, Lemkin, in 1945, he wrote up this convention on genocide and delivered it to the United Nations, and they threw him out and gutted it. And they made sure that what was passed would not hold any of them to account or any Americans to account for the genocide that was going on around the world at the time or for what we did in Germany or in France or in Japan, for example, with our bombing, you know? So there's a political economy of everything, and it's all about these interests. And again, the point is people are terrified of talking about genocide, speaking about it the way it really is. And for that, they need to read the book A Little Matter of Genocide by Ward Churchill, because that's the document on the subject.
Great book.
And, of course, Churchill wrote the book about the destruction of the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement.
Yes, the Colin Fell Pro and all that,
Right, Agents of Repression.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, you hit the button on the nose. It's white journalists and non-white journalists who go in there. They don't want to see it. They don't talk about capitalist interests. They know perfectly well they have to self-censor, and then they do, and it's all about their paycheck, and it's all about having $5,000 worth of camera equipment, and knowing that if they drop their camera equipment off the airplane at this moment, National Geographic or whoever will send them brand new equipment tomorrow by FedEx. And
exactly.
It's about their special perks, like the adventure travel of it, you know? And it's about going off into Africa and with some romantic idea that you're going to meet some white Tarzan Jane somewhere and you're going to have your little romance in the jungle. I mean, this is what white supremacy is about, and this is what's going on in Africa.
If people are listening right now, and by this time, if you've been listening to the entire program, or even if you just caught the last 15 minutes of the program and what Brother Keith has been talking about, you can tell that his work is expansive. The amount of research and work that he has put into these documents that he's produced and the journalism that there's a reason why he's not working for the New York Times or Washington Post or what have you, because obviously they're connected and this is not the kind of journalism. This is not the kind of contextual journalism that the U.S. mainstream media produces, but
they don't produce any contextual journalism.
No, yeah, you're exactly
not
right.
Not at all.
No, none. And he doesn't get this. Keith doesn't get this just from doing a lot of research online and libraries. Certainly that's part of it, but he has to go there, and he's been there many times. But it costs money. It costs money, and so I want to use the time the 10 or 9 or so minutes that we have left, Keith, number one, to talk about how, because I'm sure people are listening right now, and I'm hoping that one of the things that's, being bandied about in their minds is in terms of how can they support you? How can they help you, help other folks? How can they be a part of that? How can they support you? Because I know that these things, unfortunately, that in this capitalist society, it costs money to do this kind of work. How can they get in contact with you? I know that you do presentations. I know that last weekend you were in Chicago doing a presentation, but you do presentations all over the place. You do investigative journalism, and you do a lot of the dirty work that so few do. So how can they get in contact with you? What's your website, your email, and then what are small to large things that people can do independently to try to, whether it's getting the word out or just trying to see if we can, mitigate, what's going on, not just in Congo, but in so many parts of Africa. We're looking at Somalia and the pirates. We've been getting to that, but your contact information, how can they help support you?
Yeah, that whole pirate thing is, of course, a front as well. Israel was shipping weapons into Sudan in that pirate story, but nobody told you about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, one of the things that I would like people to think about is that, maybe they don't want to support me as an individual. They could support the Wake Up Project at Friends of the Congo. Friends of the Congo,
yeah.
I'm not connected with Friends of the Congo, but the Wake Up Project is a good project that needs funding, and you can find it on their projects list. There's other projects that they're doing that are good. StopExcision.net is another project in Mali to stop female genital mutilation, which is very important. StopExcision.net. And then CEGUN, the campaign to stop genocide in Uganda now, but CEGUN, just search on that. These are three groups that I'm not working for, that I have no vested interest in at this point, that help people in Africa, and they need your help. And feel free to get in touch with them and help them out. My website. Sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. Real quick, I just wanted to plug Friends of the Congo. That's friendsofthecongo.org. That's friendsofthecongo.org. Some really great individuals, from Paul Pumphrey to Maurice Carney to Brother Kambali. They've been doing some outstanding, outstanding work. So, yeah, Brother Keith is exactly right. They could definitely use our support as well.
And me personally, I'm trying to produce a report about this plantation slavery. And at this point, I've done a lot of the research, almost all the research. I don't need to go to Africa. I don't need to do that. I just need somebody to help me fund the production of the report, which would be graphic design and reproduction to distribute. And so anything that people want to donate towards that would be very, very, very important and useful. And you can do that through my website, allthingspass.com, P-A-S-S, allthingspass.com. And sadly, I can't even maintain the website. I don't have anybody to maintain it. It's sort of out of date. And at the same time, everything on it is still true for the most part. And there is a PayPal button, and people could contact me if they would rather send something in the mail. And I do have some projects that I won't talk about publicly because I don't want, I you know, it's Sun Tzu's Art of War. You don't tell somebody you're coming at them.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, but they revolve around mostly Congo, and I did, you know, I did work in Afghanistan as well, and I'm very concerned about Afghanistan and also, you know, Somalia, Sudan. These are big topics. I would really love to take a trip to Somalia to get the truth out about that, but also Darfur. You know, I know perfectly well what's happening there, but getting the real nuts and bolts of the situation on the ground is quite a different story. But the little things that people can do is just, you know, $20 makes a huge difference. And, you know, as one of my African-American teachers, Dr. Enoch Page from the University of Massachusetts, he's one of the experts, he's an anthropologist, one of the experts on white supremacy in the world. You should get in touch with Dr. Page and have him talk to your organizations or your groups. You can also bring me into colleges to speak as well, and I give quite a knockout multimedia presentation with images talking about these issues, and I get students motivated, et cetera. But Dr. Page, just to point out what's really important is to recognize that are you going to save your body? Are you going to sacrifice your children to save your body? Mm. We only have one life, and this is the time to help out people in Africa. You know, the Congo has suffered for far too long, and there's no alleviation in sight. There's all these so-called activists pushing it in the way that will make it look like there's something good happening for Congo, but it's really about greater plunder by corporations and individuals. And another report that I'd like to produce is one about Maurice Templespan. And I've done a lot of the research, and it's, you know, it's almost together. But I do live under the poverty line, and you know, it's a struggle when you don't get any income from any of these sources. And the people that are writing about the Congo in a magazine like In These Times, for example, and get a paycheck for that of $200, that $200 makes a difference. But I can't get into the magazine. And
folks,
that's because I believe these magazines are about private profit. They're not about telling the truth. They're about selling copy. And they don't want to sell copy to people and accuse them of being white supremacists or that they need to examine their whiteness. You know, you just don't tell people that.
That's right. And, you know, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the program. And I'm sure that I'm going to get a lot of phone calls and emails requesting you in the future. So the invitation, it's an open invitation. Anytime that you want to come back on the program and talk about any new research that you're doing, Keith, the door is open. And folks, once again, his website is allthingspass.com. That's allthingspass.com. You can go on there. You can make a PayPal donation to his work. And his work is directly helping other folks. He didn't mention the fact that he's worked towards sending food and medical supplies and basic health necessities to a great number of people within the continent, throughout Congo and throughout other parts of Africa. But it costs money. And so please visit the website. Keith, I just want to thank you once again. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning in. You can see why I wasn't taking any calls today, because we had a lot of stuff to cover. And it's probably the reason why we're going to have Keith on, you know, sometime in the future, because there's such a great wealth of knowledge. Yeah.
I appreciate your passion, brother. I appreciate you very much having me on. I beg your forgiveness for letting me talk so much.
No, not at all, man. Not at all. No, I'm not going to accept that apology, because it was a gift to the show, to the listeners, and to humanity, because speaking truth to power raises the specter of consciousness. And to paraphrase Dr. King, you know, he said, if you're complicit with some kind of evil that's going on, you know, you are as much a part of that evil as the people that are perpetrating that. So thank you once again, Keith, and thanks for everyone for listening. This has been Your World News. Take care.
Bless,
and
bless everyone out there. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This all probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans.
The African
Holocaust,
baby.
We're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about...
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Oh, damn.
You think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of their pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all shuckin' diving.
Yeah, it's about
grinning and smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That Turner Devil Burner come to burn your sister flame.
We gon' burn it
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans, 1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back. Cracker, tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box. I will crack a jack. After that, ain't nothing else to do but to holler black. 1 million kids who ain't got no options. Either they down with the goons or the
goblins.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is the Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that don't mean to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Your niggas got it backwards. Your niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about 1 billion people, maybe even 2. We're taking nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though.
Breaking more.
I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at your door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often. 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
Harriet Tubman came too. We got a long legacy. This is how we do it. Uno the prophet, Nat Turner, Devil Burner. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget.
I'm in it.